We're going to bring companies back to our country. You look at even today, as I was driving over, I see these empty, old, beautiful, like steel mills and factories that are empty and falling down. Some have been converted to senior citizens' homes, but that's not going to do the trick. And we're going to bring the companies back. We're going to lower taxes still further for companies that are going to make their product in the USA. We're going to protect those companies with strong tariffs, because I'm a believer in tariffs. I'm not sure that you are. I don't think you are, but I congratulate you on your career. But to me, the most beautiful word in the dictionary is tariff. And it's my favorite word. It needs a public relations firm to help it. But to me, it's the most beautiful word in the dictionary.
This is the Debunking Economics Podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
Yes, terrific tariffs. So beautiful in Trump's eyes. Shall I compare thee to a summer's day? But will it work, Trump's tariff plan, or will it create inflation, or will it inhibit global trade, or will a stronger dollar actually mean it hurts US exports? How will it all shake out? Has he thought through all of these permutations? Well, half of America clearly loves the idea, so it's going to happen. What does it mean for the rest of us? We'll look at that this week on the Debunking Economics Podcast. So Donald Trump wants to impose tariffs on China and the rest of the world, really, but specifically China, to get businesses to base production within the US rather than outsource overseas where labor is cheaper. So, Steve, the US imports about $450 billion in goods from China. He imposed tariffs of 25% on half of that. Now he wants to go 50% on everything. I wonder if it's going to work. There's early signs that actually people are responding. So the CEO of Breville in Australia has said, you know, Breville was actually an Australian company. I learned that this last week.
He said that for quite some years.
Yeah. Well, I mean, so there we are. That's great. There's Australian, quite a big company.
Probably our most successful manufacturing company.
Yeah. Making good stuff and expanding. Yeah. Anyway, the CEO has said that they are already moving to their production out of China. They're trying to build up their inventory in the United States, you know, as much as possible. Let's get as much inventory into the country before the tariffs start. And then, their share price fell 3% on the day that Trump was elected. But if they move to the US, then Donald Trump is winning, isn't it? His plan is working.
Yeah, and this is, it's actually, there's been 50 years of American policy predicated on free trade being advantageous, which the Chinese exploited very effectively to build up their manufacturing capabilities. And now, I think it's except in a handful of industries, China is outcompeting America across the manufacturing spectrum. And this is, you know, in terms of how well the policy has worked, the previous free trade policy, the answer is very well for China, not particularly well for America, which is the inverse of what you normally expect with policy. The economic theory said both sides would benefit. Well, I think Trump is picking up on the feelings of now, we've got to say, as the majority of Americans, since he won a majority of the popular vote, that this hasn't worked out well and we want a reverse direction.
Yeah, but the price associated with that's the question. We'll come to that in a second. Let's just finish off with Breville. Their CEO said now they're looking at moving to Mexico. I guess he thinks that's because Mexico is part of the North America Free Trade Agreement, the NAFTA, which would mean that, you know, it would be tariff-free into the US. But we look at the last Trump administration, and in 2019, he said, right, we're going to put 5% tariff on Mexico, and then each month thereafter, up to a maximum of 25%, we're going to increase it unless Mexico takes steps to stop illegal immigration from Mexico into the United States. It didn't happen because Mexico said it would try and increase security measures. So that was a case of Trump, you know, just doing his own whole art of the deal thing. But it does show that things like free trade agreements, you know, are not sacrosanct, that they can be ripped up at any moment. If you move a business into Mexico thinking that you're going to get free trade into the US, which could be abolished, that agreement could be abolished after you've spent a fortune setting up a factory, it's not safe to draw any conclusions, is it?
And the only safe one is the one that he's trying to push for, people to move manufacturing to America. And, you know, on this front, he's The fact that he's so capricious means that you simply can't expect any existing agreements going to be continued with. So the only place to, if you want to get into America by avoiding tariffs, the only place to make this stuff is in the US of A.
But about, just on Mexico, 80% of their exports go to America. So Mexico is hugely dependent on the United States for its own economy. If there was a 20% tariff or a 25% tariff, I wonder how much of that would be compensated for by the fact that Mexican currency would become so much weaker. Whether the peso, I mean, curiously, actually, this year, the peso has been climbing. It's gone from 16 peso to the dollar to almost 21. And the news of the, you know, Trump 2.0 hasn't stopped that climb. But I wonder whether, you know, in fact, if you started to see trade diminishing, you'd just see the peso massively drop in value, and that would negate some of that impact of that tariff.
Yeah, I mean, in the currency movements, obviously, can go in the opposite direction of tariffs, so that can make the point. I think Trump is probably looking at the volume of exports, and those volume continued rising. That he continued with the policy, so I wouldn't respond to this by moving to a country which currently has a free trade agreement with America. I think if you're going to respond to this, then you know the only option is moving your production base to America. And that's what Andrew Trump, of course, the other thing he wants to do is encourage American companies. So it's very nationalist. This is the basic point of his administration. It's a very nationalist America first administration on everything. And obviously, when it comes to trade, he's not going to be happy, or his team won't be happy if they see the volume of the Mexican exports still rising despite the other measures. So,
but what happens if you don't? Irrespective of whether people move to Mexico or not, I mean, Mexico is currently, as I say, 80% of their exports go to the United States. If that door gets closed, what happens to the Mexican economy? What happens to those Mexican people who all of a sudden can't afford to feed their families? What do they do?
Yeah. Well, that leads to political turmoil in Mexico, which has had a fair share of that itself anyway.
Which is their next door neighbor. And obviously more and more of them then try and make it to the United States.
Yeah. But it depends on how much complexity the country has managed to gain by taking advantage of exports to America over time. And in that front, China is absolutely the winner, because you cut China off from the rest of the world or try to do it, and it's going to say, okay, we'll just continue developing for our domestic production and consumption base. Because you have to have been to China before this whole transition occurred to appreciate how dramatically the country's been transformed into a manufacturing powerhouse. Because I, in 1980, 81, 82, I was visiting Chinese factories with a group of Australian journalists. I took there for a conference with Chinese journalists, and we were going inside factories making incandescent light bulbs, and it was hand assembly. It was incredibly primitive stuff, and the same for some of its gas, its projects in the countryside, methane from pigs being used to power a local production facility. That itself was not a bad thing, but the level of technology was just way, way, way behind.
Yeah,
what
although
was
they are
the West. You go there
back,
now,
yeah,
and you're
stepping
you,
it up.
You
now.
Go,
you
feel like you've gone to a, you know, a either in your Disneyland or you've moved to Star Trek. I mean, the quality of manufacturing and the infrastructure in China is just stunning. And that's just in a 45-year period.
Yeah.
So,
but
they,
what they have, what they are having the problem with, though, is, you know, that move to domestic demand. They are producing a surplus of goods, always have, still exists today. Because they are, you know, hell bent on exports. So if this transition to domestic consumption is proving very difficult for them.
I think they'll still manage it. I mean, because it's the level of consumption of Chinese people now is, you know, orders of magnitude, and that is maybe two orders of magnitude improvement. Certainly one order over the last 40 years. It's dramatic how much more consumption Chinese people are used to compared to what they had back in the days of the Mao regime. So don't underrate the capacity of Chinese consumers to consume.
But, well, it's just taking a while, that's all. And meanwhile, I mean, China's approach obviously would be to try and weaken the yuan as much as possible. Export nations want a lower value, obviously, in their currency to make their exports even cheaper. So what if the dollar strengthens and all other currencies weaken, because that's what's got to happen. If the US dollar strengthens, then everyone else has got to be down, or, you know, at least, you know, the constituent parts of the DXY, depending on how you're measuring the strength of the US dollar, then, it becomes cheaper to import in the United States and more expensive to export. So is that really a win for America?
Well, I mean, America needs to revive what it used to have in terms of a manufacturing capability. And whenever I get involved in the discussion of trade, the first thing I turn to is the Atlas of Economic Complexity System, which is run by Harvard University and uses a set of computer statistical devices to measure how sophisticated a manufacturing system a country has. Now, America back in 2000, that's not long ago. I wish the database went further back on that front. But in 2000, America ranked number 6 in the world. It now ranks number 14. If you take a look at China over the same time period, China, I'm just going to type in its name here in the system, China was number 39 in 2000. It's now number 18. So a few more years of the current trend and China will rank as more sophisticated in terms of the goods it can produce than America, which is the world's top nation. Now, what country do you think holds the number one position?
Oh, gee, I don't know. That's an interesting one. Japan?
Yes, and it's held consistently for the last 21 years. Right. So the Economic Complexity Index, number one since 2000 right to 2021, is still Japan. So
The idea being that the more industry, and we've talked about this in the past, the more industries you've got, the more cross-fertilization between those industries, therefore the opportunity for new initiatives to be developed. You get a more innovative culture.
That's right, yeah. And then as China's going at some point, like in the next 3 or 4 years, it'll pass America in terms of its capacity to produce complex goods. And of course, one of the most important ones there is integrated circuits. If the trade embargo that America's put on China already means that China develops its own equivalent of AMSL, then the Dutch company that dominates, it's the only company that makes devices that can make the smaller scale of microchips. If they produce that, then China becomes dramatically self-sufficient here. And that's my long-term perspective, that with what I expect from climate change and its impact upon global economies, the capacity to produce what you need domestically is absolutely critical. Mm. The days of focusing upon globalization, I think, are over. And in that sense, I'm not dismayed by what Trump is trying to do on that front for America, because given what's coming our way, it's going to be each country for itself. And the more you can produce of your own needs, the less likely you are to have a collapse caused by climate change.
Well, it has started to happen a little bit, hasn't it, as a result of what we saw with the pandemic and the shock that produced to supply chains. I think every company realized the need to shorten those supply chains and more onshoring. But let's finish off before the break on this idea of the currency, though. Because if America, which, has been a big net importer, all of a sudden, I mean, I don't think it'll ever get to the stage where it's exporting more than it imports. But if it gets closer to it, then we are going to see a response in the US dollar, aren't we? The US dollar is going to rise. It's up almost 7% anyway over the last 12 months. That's before Donald Trump's got his feet under the desk. So maybe it's going to be 10, 15% up. And that does sort of negate, we're looking at 20% tariffs around the world. That sort of negates the impact of those tariffs. So what does he do? Is he say, well, okay, I'll put the tariffs up even more then. Because obviously currencies have to level out.
The only way out of the value currency for America is to cease being a country, the global reserve currency. This is the main problem. And the fact that the Americans under Harry Dexter White at the Bretton Woods insisted that the American dollar become the reserve currency rather than Keynes's idea of a clearinghouse using what he called a bank call, inevitably meant that the American dollar has to be overvalued because every country on the planet needs to have American dollars to engage in trade, whether or not they're buying American goods. And that's then necessarily was an advantage for the American financial system and a disadvantage for the manufacturing system. So
yeah,
one in 10 transactions,
I think I read somewhere, one in 10 transactions with the US dollar actually involves the United States. But do you think the US would relinquish that position?
Certainly not, not under Trump. I mean, you know, again, the whole...
But if he's got a rising dollar, if he's hit with the problem that his policies are causing the US dollar to get stronger and stronger by the day, and that's negating the effect of his tariffs, then he's got a problem, hasn't he?
Absolutely.
So what does he do about that?
Your guess is as good as mine on what Trump will do.
Puts tariffs up even more, I guess.
Most likely. I mean, but it's inevitable. It's a problem which, it's easy for a country that's not the reserve currency to whack up tariffs and not have a particularly dramatic effect upon its exchange rate. But America does it, then, and you know, the reserve currency also, which necessarily has to run a trade deficit. To enable those dollars to turn up in foreign countries for them to be able to re-import back in America, they're caught both ways. There's no way they can do one without the other happening, moving in a compensating direction.
But it doesn't help innovation from American side of point of view. It's sort of backward looking to say jobs that have gone overseas. For companies that are trying to serve our domestic market, we want those jobs to come back. The price we're going to pay for that is, well, first of all, those goods are going to be more expensive. We'll come to that after the break. But the other thing is we're going to have a strong US dollar as a response of that. The effect of that is for anybody in the US who's exporting, all of a sudden the cost of US goods become more expensive. It becomes an expensive place to create goods for the rest of the world. So the innovator will say, well, okay, the US is the last place in the world I want to be. So, for example, you know, everything that Microsoft or anybody else produces all of a sudden goes up 10% just by exchange rate fluctuations.
It's a dilemma. There's no easy way out of it. He's going to find out about the hard way.
Yeah. Do you think he's thought about it? I don't think he thinks that far. No, I'm sure he hasn't. All right, okay. I wonder if he's thought about inflation as well. We'll talk about that because that's the one thing obviously everyone is pointing to. This is going to be inflationary. What's the Reserve Bank going to do about that, or the Federal Reserve? We'll look at that when we come back. It's the Debunking Economics podcast. We are talking about terrific, get it, Trump on the show today. Back in a moment.
This is the Debunking Economics podcast with Steve Keen and Phil Dobby.
So, Steve, if manufacturing is brought back into the US, I mean, I wonder how much it is going to help America, where the average wage is more than four times what it is in China, six times what it is in Mexico. So say the average value of a good is 30% of its cost is based on labor. So something that costs $100 from China could cost twice that amount in the United States, if it's produced in the United States. So actually, people would still find it cheaper to buy that good from China unless the tariff on Chinese goods is 100%, doubling the cost.
There are also other issues, which are about the level of markups. So a large part of the increase in inflation in recent decades has been by firms increasing their markups by more than the rate of inflation. It's not just wages that cause a higher level of costs. So you've got huge profit margins, a part of the cost of them buying goods in America, as well as the wage levels. I don't know what the comparable situation is in China, but the odds are that another way that American manufacturing could compete is by reducing their markups. So it's not totally fixed that, you know, with a high wage cost you can't compete. And the main thing is it's not high wage, it's low skill. I've come back to, I've forgotten a particular executive who was running Apple at the time, but his comment about if he wanted to have a meeting of all the machine tool skilled labor for machine tools in America, you'd hold it in his boardroom. If you wanted to hold thing inside, say in China, you'd need the world's biggest football stadium. So the level of skilled labor and the capacity to mechanize is something that's, again, it should be higher in America, but in fact, it's higher in China. So what this, a large part of the way
to... So you can't bring those jobs back. The people don't exist to do them. The skill set doesn't exist to do it.
Not in America. And that's the trouble. They haven't, you know, the education is another barrier for any development like this in America. And you used to have, apprentice type of, training, which I think the Germans are still relatively good at that. They left everything else in their industrial system slip. But the role of an apprenticeship and training on site, and then development of technology and training of staff to match with it, the Chinese seem far in advance of America on that front because they're investing in their people rather than trying to exploit them, which is the main American activity.
Yeah, well, therein lies the problem as well then. So you could say, well, okay, this is a two-step process. We need to bring these jobs back on shore, and to do that, we need to skill up so that we can replace the jobs that we've outsourced to China and develop those skills nationally. Therefore, we need to spend money on education. Ah, damn it, we've just appointed Elon Musk, who's just said he's going to reduce government spending by a third. Mm. Two things don't add up.
I think a lot of stuff doesn't add up in what they're going to be attempting to do. I mean, knocking $2 trillion, that's 10% of the bloody economy, pretty much.
I know, but don't worry, because those people, obviously, who were working for the government will now be are freed up to work in private enterprise and earn more. Curious why they chose the government in the first place, really.
Yeah, I know.
Because from that, that very low unemployment rate that he's got, he's going to get it into negative figures. Well, that's after, of course, you got rid of the 2 million people who are going to be deported. Yeah, none of it stacks up.
And none of it stacks up. It's going to be fascinating to watch. I mean, it's popcorn territory for the rest of the planet.
So when you talk about the margins, as you were saying, so, you know, the idea that really to compensate for the lower labor costs in China, you'd have to, you basically could be doubling the cost of every item. Okay, this margin, you might not be quite so bad because you get margin squeeze. Because as you say, there might have been massive margins that have been happening in the United States. But you see, Donald Trump will be a big supporter of that because those massive margins have been helping the share price. And the share indices are what Donald Trump measures as the success of an economy. Nothing else, just how share prices are going. So they've been going well because companies have been giving very big profits because of those profit margins that you're talking about. So I don't know if he's thought that through either. Those profit margins could well get squeezed and their share prices fall.
Yeah, embracing myself, what's going to happen on Twitter again, because one of the reasons I was active on Twitter was watching what the hell is Trump going to do next in the last term. It's going to be that on steroids this time around, and of course, accompanied by Musk as well. So we're going to see whatever dilemmas they have, we're going to be seeing very publicly on Twitter.
So you've turned, it seems like in the last 20 minutes or so, you've turned around a little bit. You were at the very beginning, you were very supportive of what he was trying to do.
Well, no, I'm supportive of the concept, but because this comes back to the academic obsession with free trade, and that's something I've always been a critic of. And in that sense, if Trump's going to snub his nose, though, that's an improvement. But at the same time, you've got all the dilemmas, you know, that he's doing other, if he's going to try to promote trade while also expanding government money creation, then that would be actually be more feasible. You'd be creating the money that could enable colleges to be formed so you could train people, you could get apprenticeship schemes and so on. Because they're going to try to cut back on all that and say it's just coming down to the private sector, they're going to be hitting the economy. If he actually does try to knock $2 trillion off with a 10% fall in GDP, if they're lucky, that's not the circumstances in which firms invest. So a lot of what they're doing is counterproductive. But getting away from the obsession with free trade is something that I think is necessary. And as crazy as Trump is on other fronts, he is a skeptic on that. And he's got every right to be a skeptic, because when you take a look at the arguments in favor of free trade, it's more theories at the bottom of the garden thinking by conventional economists. And that goes right back to Ricardo's original arguments for it.
But he is going to, obviously, if he imposes tariffs, he's going to start a trade war. So Europe's not going to say, we'll take that 20% tariff, but we'll raise you 20%. In fact, I would imagine Europe would say, well, we're going to charge you 20%. By the way, it seems like you're not particularly interested in climate change. So you are producing, your export goods are produced without any impost on, the effects of climate change. You are not meeting your contractual obligations as a good citizen of the planet on that. So we're going to actually increase our tariffs on that as well. So it's, you know, there's no doubt there'll be a trade war from all of this. And
but the thing, what worries me is the trade war will be blamed for the collapse in economic output. But at the same time, the economic output collapse is more likely to be caused by crushing government money creation, which is what is the major objective that Musk has, is now the head of the Department of Government Efficiency, otherwise known as DOGE. So that's going to trash the economy that way. And then what will be blamed for the trashing of the economy is the trade collapse. But at the same time, with what's coming with global warming, I think the only way that a country is going to have any chance of surviving is being by being self-sufficient in the absolute essentials for human consumption. And in that front, it's going to be countries which are domestically self-sufficient that matter. So if all countries turn towards that as an orientation rather than towards free trade and extended supply chains, as we saw before COVID, as weird as a way is to get to it, that's actually more sustainable in the long term.
So for sure,
than relying upon globalization.
So maybe a tariff war is a good thing if it forces the US and Europe and parts of Asia all to become much more insular in their outlook, and Britain just needs to rejoin Europe as quick as possible. So we're not trying to do everything on a very small.
Yeah, there's a minimum scale to which you can go. But I want to just actually read into the record the original Ricardo argument for comparative advantage, because this is the core, I think, of where mainstream economics comes from, and its fallacies at the same time. And this is from page 135 of Ricardo's Principles. And he made the comment, what he was doing was attacking Ricardo's objective in putting forward the theory of comparative advantage was to attack the Corn Laws. And the Corn Laws prevented the importing of wheat, fundamentally, from the European mainland into the UK, which meant large profits for English-based wheat producers. And Ricardo's argument was that means money goes to landlords who are going to waste it on frivolous expenditure. Whereas if you allow the importation of European grain, that will reduce the cost of feeding the workers. The workers will still get the same amount of grain. It'll just cost the capitalists less to do it. They'll pay less to the landlords and there'll be more investment. So Ricardo's orientation was actually to increase domestic investment and the focus upon the importance of manufacturing.
What's wrong with that?
But, well, the thing is, the way he made the case, most people have fallen for what I call a shell and pea trick. So what he said was that you take the example of where Portugal is more efficient than England in both wheat production and wine production. I think it's cloth production. You use cloth production and wine production. And so that even if the argument was for the opponents of deregulating was that if you deregulate, Portugal's better at everything than we are, so it'll wipe out domestic manufacturing. And what Ricardo said is, well, I'm going to assume that Portugal is better at both wine than cloth. So it takes England 100 men to make a certain amount of cloth, where it takes Portugal 90. And then if you look at UK, England try to do wine, it'd be 120, whereas Portugal can do it with 70. Then if there's if the British stop producing wine, because he actually knew they didn't, he made a little facetious comment about that in the book, and to devote all their capital to producing cloth, and then Portugal stops producing cloth and devotes all its resources to producing wine, there'll be an increase in the amount of cloth and the amount of wine in aggregate, and everybody will benefit. And that's the argument for comparative advantage in trade. But Ricardo got what he wanted, which was to reduce the cost of labor and to enable more money to go to capitalists and less to go to landlords. That's his real objective. But people fell for this argument. And the problem is that you don't just make those commodities with labor. You need machinery as well. And what Ricardo did is the classic case of confusing monetary capital with physical capital. So he talks about why is this going to be advantageous to expand trade with Portugal versus expanding domestic production. And he says, this is the quote, "The difference in this respect between a single country and many is easily accounted for by considering the difficulty with which capital moves from one one country to another to seek a more profitable employment, and the activity with which it invariably passes from one province to another within the same country. But that's true if you're moving a sheep dip or, you know, spinning jenny from some location in Scotland to another location in the UK, in England somewhere, making a physical capital. That's easy. It's easy to move the monetary capital. It is not easy to turn a spinning jenny into a wine press. And this is the physical aspect of capital that's ignored by neoclassical theory all the time. It's the physical resources you need to produce the physical goods. They leave out the impact of capital. The only way you're going to get new capital is to invest. It's not a case of allocating your existing capital more efficiently, which is the whole focus of comparative advantage. It's increasing the physical resources you have. So this is just a fallacious argument. It should never have been taken seriously. But the fundamental driver of improving trade positions is increasing investment, not reallocating existing physical capital, because you can't move physical capital from cloth manufacturing to wine manufacturing or anything.
And you'd assume that Donald Trump is going to see much greater investment now in the United States because
that's what he wants. Yeah,
he is a market.
Yeah.
We've got the market. We've got all these people. They've all got money. They're all going to buy stuff. We are going to stop importing stuff. Therefore, we need to ramp up our domestic production capability. So invest now. At what expense? I mean, does all the world's money go into the United States as part of this experiment, which means there's massive underinvestment elsewhere?
It just means American corporations won't be offshoring anymore. And this is why China built itself up. I got to go back to my experience in China 40 years ago. We went to the Shenzhen Free Trade Zone while they were laying the concrete. So it was literally before the thing actually opened up, and had a meeting with the managers, who were the most impressive people I met in China. And their argument was there's a loophole in the American trade agreement that allows an American corporation to export semi-finished goods to a third world country, have it worked on there and re-import without paying a tariff on the extra work. So this is the weakness in the tariff system, a deliberate weakness to benefit third world countries back in the 80s and 90s. And the Chinese said, we're going to take advantage of that. But to get American corporations to move to the free trade zone, and we're also going to require them to have a Chinese partner, and the Chinese partner has to own 50% of the business within 7 years. Now, that gives you an idea of the scale of drop in wage costs that was a real motivation for that relocation
for sure.
of production.
So if all of that's being reversed now, obviously the cost of wages has gone up in the United States. The issue actually is, Mexico, which is wages are very low. So the question is are they going to find that they have to, you know, just shift production from China to Mexico, which is, you know, where we get back to, where we started with perhaps Breville is right, because they are not going to have the workforce in the US. And if the response to that is, well, we don't need the workforce because we are bringing these companies back, and because there's not enough labor, and because labor is so expensive, we're going to have to automate. So you're going to have we're going to have to buy in the machines for us to be, strangely, from China, actually. Interestingly, that was one of the things that was tariff-free in Trump's last term was anything that helps us produce domestically. We won't put tariffs on that. But I wonder whether he will this time around. But anyway, those machines come into the United States. Those machines are replacing people. So actually, he's arguing that this is to get jobs for the Rust Belt. But, you know, he got unemployment when he was around last time down to 3.5%. There's not, you know, in theory, there's not that many people looking for work. If jobs get replaced by machines, he's not really helping those people in the Rust Belt, is he? Unless he sticks the machines in the Rust Belt, you know, and employs the person who turns it on in the morning.
Well, you need some skilled labor to go with those technologies. There's also a lot of unskilled labor, which can be relatively easily trained. I can imagine what Musk is thinking about is his army of robots coming into that area. Mm-hmm. But the overall objective is to rebuild American manufacturing. And having spent some time in America recently, it needs it. Whether the policies work or not, I can understand the emphasis,
motivation. Yeah,
but of course, it's going to be it'll be done in the usual chaotic sense that Trump brings to anything. The days of ease negotiations and slow change to regulations are over.
And the other side of it is, which touched on, is this lack of understanding about how money is created. So if they're scooping money out from the federal government, and then they're putting all the responsibility to the state governments, who obviously can't create money. So, California's got a $200 billion budget. 70% of that goes on health and human services, almost $100 billion on education. There, 20% of the state's GDP is state government spending. So all the important stuff, health, education, rests with the states. Defence rests at the federal level. Obviously, he's not going to scoop any jobs or any spending out of the military, which I think is about a third of all the government spending. So, there's going to be more focus on meeting obligations at the state level. And obviously the state level can't create money.
Yeah. And they're also going to be probably starved of funds, I expect, in terms of the administration have to put up their state taxes. So, And it's, as I said, it's popcorn territory for the rest of the world as these policies are tried out. Like at a fundamental level, I still think you have to have more domestic production because I think globalization it's already going backwards. But by the fact that it hasn't led to the increase in the income levels of the wealthy countries that thought they would benefit from globalization. This is America's situation in particular, because a major argument in favor was, let's specialize what we're best at. Now, that'll increase the incomes of both the importing and the exporting nations. Well, America's been doing pretty badly on that front, and China's been doing pretty well. There's that alone is causing, even though the people still swallow conventional economic theory on this front, the level of satisfaction with that, the outcome is definitely not what it was supposed to be, because the outcome has been the opposite, declining living standards in America relative to China, whereas they're both supposed to benefit. So that alone was a problem. But with global warming is going to cut off, if we think COVID broke supply chains, wait until we start to see weather catastrophes destroying productive capabilities in some countries, and then those countries refusing to export anymore. The classic example at the moment is that India no longer exports rice, except for basmati rice, in the response to a couple of climate catastrophes with wheat crops in India, with rice crops in India. So at some point, countries are going to say, that's it, we're not exporting anymore. And then that goes your supply chain, unless you produced it domestically.
Right. And I wonder, so just on the final point then, I wonder whether actually Donald Trump is helping us all do that. So by imposing tariffs and then, tariffs in retaliation, will Europe have to become more self-sufficient as a result?
I think that's feasible. So, as much as being done for crazy reasons, the actual logic behind the current structure is even crazier. So a bit of, Trump crazy in the opposite direction may be beneficial.
Yeah. Well, hell, Europe needs it, doesn't it? It needs a burst of enthusiasm and a bit of investment. But actually, if you were looking as to where you put your money, if you're an investor and you're thinking, well, okay, because all money is flowing to the States at the moment, it's amazing how all of a sudden investors, because the investment community love Trump, of course, so they're putting money into the US because they see this opportunity for growth. But actually, maybe the smart money should equally be going to Europe, because they will have to invest to retaliate.
They've got an even bigger constraint, and that's the Maastricht Treaty and the limitation on government spending.
Yeah.
So I think
But Trump's giving himself the same disadvantage, of course.
He is. Yeah, well, they focus on eliminating the capacity of the government to create money without knowing that's what he's doing, without understanding that interest payments aren't a cost of the government for borrowing. It's meaning they're creating too much money for the financial sector. So all this stuff is completely missed by Musk in particular, but also by Trump. At least Musk, I think, has got the intellect to understand it, but he doesn't. He hasn't got it right at the moment. So, there's all sorts of conflicting elements of the current policies of the Trump administration, and it's going to be a lot of fun watching them roll out over time.
Well, he hasn't got much time, that's the thing. But yeah, let's get the popcorn out. He's only got 4 years and, midterms, halfway through that. But I guess we've got J.D. Vance next as the next president, unless it is, of course, Elon Musk himself.
No possibility there, because he's not an American-born. So at least that's one terror you can leave out of your out of your worries, mate.
Out of the scenarios. All right, well, you can always change that. Change that law. All right. I mean, constitutional change. That's the next thing, isn't it? Anyway, we'll leave it there. Well, as you say, we'll get the popcorn out and we'll watch with interest. But yeah, it seems like even if the idea is right, there are so many impracticalities about the education that's needed to enable this structural change, and then the reaction from the rest of the world, and the possibility that the US dollar will just grow too strong as a result of this, and that's going to be an impediment to their growth as well.
Yeah, lots of people are going to be having interesting spreads on currency markets coming out of this.
They will indeed. Well, there's a useful pursuit. We'll catch you next time, Steve.
Okay, mate. Bye.
The Debunking Economics Podcast.